Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and today we'll be talking about two Latin American countries, one that's undergoing a dramatic change of leadership, and the other, a close ally of the first, where an equally dramatic change is expected sooner or later. The second country is Cuba, and Theodore Bacon of the Brookings Institute will join us for that conversation in about half an hour. But right now, the topic is Venezuela, where Hugo Chavez, the charismatic and controversial president of that country, has been dead for just a week, and plans are already underway for the next presidential election. Our guest is a political science professor at the University of Illinois who happens to be a native of Venezuela. Damaris Canache is co-editor of one book on her home country's politics and the author of another, the latter being Venezuela, that's Venezuela, Public Opinion and Protest in a Fragile Democracy. Professor Canache, welcome to Focus.
Thank you very much.
And it has been just a week since Hugo Chavez's death. How is this news sinking in among Venezuelan people? From what you can tell from your distance, you talk to some people back home, and you certainly follow the media. How is this being taken?
Well, I'm sure people have looked at and followed the news. It has been a really extraordinary event, to say the least. Few weeks before the death of Chavez, actually several weeks before, there was a lot of uncertainty about his actual health condition. And the news took Venezuela, and especially his followers, a little bit of surprising, even if it's difficult to believe. Actually, there was a survey took over the last few days, and 40% of his followers thought that Chavez would come back and would take over the government. So there have been, pours in people in the streets, in the ceremonies of things, and it has been very emotive circumstance.
For people who were not fans of President Chavez, it may have been equally surprising, but what do you hear on that side of the political spectrum?
I think there is a lot of uncertainty about what is coming up in this new era that Venezuela begins. On the one hand, we know that we are going to have elections in 1 month or so, and the outcome of that election is pretty much certain. Probably the government candidate, the incumbent government, will win the election.
That's Nicolas Maduro, the interim president, pretty much the choice of Hugo Chavez.
Yeah, he's here. He basically asked his people to vote for him if something happened to him. And he will be his successor. This is very likely the outcome of the next election. But the uncertainty I'm talking about is what is going to happen after he wins. Who will be able to rule Venezuela and solve all the problems and take the decisions that are necessary to solve the problems that Venezuela is confronting, economic problems and social problems. And that is the big question, I guess, the big interrogant that is open for Venezuela.
Well, we welcome you to the conversation as well. And if you have questions about Venezuela, the time to call is during this first half hour of Focus. Call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 to talk with Professor Canache. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. It's I'm going to ask you now to give a lot of information in a short time, and that is, what was the political landscape? What were things like in Venezuela at the time when Hugo Chavez was elected? And that was like about
1998.
And how did he change things?
1990, the 90s really, was a period of crisis in Venezuela, economic and political crisis. There was basically the demise of the political traditional parties, AD and COPEI, a lot of corruption, and again, economic crisis. And Chavez appears, as a hope for the majority of Venezuela. he was a political outsider in the sense that he didn't have a career, a political career within the traditional party. He was a military man. He launched a coup attempt that fell in the 90s. But since then, he worked into the system, his way into the system. And by 1998, this outsider was able to galvanize the support of the majority of Venezuela, not only the poor, but also the middle class and even some sectors of the elites, you know, the intellectual and economic elites in Venezuela. And so he won that election in a landslide.
And once in power, what changes did he bring to a Venezuelan government?
As you know, Chavez talked about a revolution in Venezuela, a Bolivarian revolution. That was his main vision of his rule. Then later he talked about socialism.
When we're talking about Bolivarian, we're talking about Simon Bolivar.
Simon Bolivar, yeah.
And what does that mean when you evoke his name?
His ideas and all the program that he brings when he won the election include ideas of Simon Bolivar about independence, sovereignty, nationalism. And so that is the part of the doctrine that he used in his movement. And you talk about changes. A major change that Chavez brought was a turn in of the political class. There is a new political class in Venezuela beginning in the 90s. And he introduced, he changed the constitution, drafted a new constitution, introducing important institutional changes.
And the result being is how does... Is Venezuelan society different now because of what he did?
For the changes that he introduced, and because of his leadership, I think Venezuela, politically speaking, has changed. One major change, I think, is that he incorporated politically many sectors, the poor especially, in Venezuela politics. People have organized, have become more aware of political issues, and they are more participants of the process. And that's something that Chavez did, and I think it's a positive aspect of his leadership and his impact in Venezuela.
More people have a voice and are active
yes.
in the political process
yes.
now in Venezuela.
Yeah, definitely.
The socialism part, and you described that's not something that Simon Bolivar necessarily promoted, but
yeah.
Hugo Chavez did.
Yeah.
And what did that mean for Venezuelan society? What did he do?
Well, you know, beginning in 2006 and after his re-election, he started to talk about socialism of the 21st century. And during his government, Chavez, you know, established a lot of ties and connections with Cuba. And so that influenced his thinking and his view of where Venezuela needed to move. But in reality, socialism meant up to this point in Venezuela is, you know, a state-centered economy and a state-centered society. What that means is that high interventionism, high involvement of the state in economy and in other areas of society, which is not new at all in Latin America. In particular, in the case of Chavez, have meant a lot of use of resources, distribution of resources of the state directly to the poor and through also social policies that are called misiones in Venezuela. And that was a staple of his rule.
How well has it worked? Or is that you get different answers depending on who you ask?
You get different answers depending on who you ask, exactly. In turn, because some people support it, some people don't support it. And the question is, how will that work? There have been, Venezuela, for example, the poverty level and the inequality level have decreased. Since Chavez, the Gini index, which is an indicator of income inequality, have dropped to 0.39. When you are below that, below 0.5, is a decrease in inequality. It's an indication of that. But this is a trend that has happened in Latin America generally. So Venezuela is not exclusively in that track. But at the same time, all these social misiones that have been implemented, they start very well, but there is no monitoring, supervision of that. And then you see that they start to fault in the way. So, and that's the problem in the management of many of the programs.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and my guest for the first half of the program is University of Illinois political science professor Damaris Kanache. She's affiliated with the university's Center for Latin American and Caribbean Studies, native of Venezuela herself, and we're talking about Venezuela in the wake of the death of its longtime president, Hugo Chavez. In the second half of our program, we'll be talking about Cuba with Ted Picone of the Brookings Institute. Still time to join us on air. Call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. And I was wondering, because one thing you read about Hugo Chavez is that he was he spoke at length. He was he did a lot of public speaking. He gave long speeches, like Fidel Castro's. It sounds like maybe a model for him.
Yeah.
He had a regular TV show, which also could be quite long. If you lived in Venezuela, you had an opportunity to hear a lot of Hugo Chavez. What was that like? How was Hugo Chavez as a speaker?
Well, he was, as you introduced him, we talk about him, he was extremely charismatic, has this quality, and he was a great speaker. I guess one of his keys of the success is that he was an archetypical Venezuelan. He was the common Venezuelan, and he was able to talk to people as a friend, as somebody that you know, people, you know, develop that empathy with him immediately. And he has this show that you mentioned. It was called Aló Presidente. I don't know how many hundreds of Aló Presidente happened during his years of government in Venezuela. Just when he became sick, he stopped basically. But it was every Sunday. And as you say, he could spend 3 hours, he could spend five, he could spend 8 hours talking. And it was somebody that you have basically in your house all the time, because he was a lot of time in TV. So people get, you know, very familiar with him. And I say the way in which he talked, it was like you were talking with somebody that you knew it. And that was part of his success, definitely.
By comparison, how is Nicolas Maduro as a public speaker, the interim president?
He is something that we are going to find out now where he's campaigning. He's very quiet. He was the vice president and he was a foreign minister during Chavez. And observers and analysts describe him as a, you know, jovial, quiet individual. But now he has to campaign. And so we are going to start to learn more about him as a politician. The first few appearances since he have been in charge of the government over the last week, you know, I guess have mixed opinion in terms of how he's going to stand to the shoes of Chavez. He's no Chavez, that for sure. So,
the opposition leader, Enrique Capriles, who's running against Maduro in the election next month, even if he doesn't win, he's probably still going to be around.
Mm-hmm.
And I take it he did respectably compared to past elections in the October election. What has he brought to the table? First of all, what is the basic message of the opposition party coming up against Chavismo? What do they have to offer? What's the case they make to people who might have been supporting Chavez all this time?
Yeah. So the candidate of the position is Enrique Capriles. He ran against Chavez in October 2007, and he won 44% of the vote. He actually is the governor of one state, Miranda, which is one of the largest and more densely populated states in Venezuela. So he has a leadership in the country. I assume, I mean, the campaign hasn't started. He just yesterday, both candidates registered their candidacy and the National Electoral Institute. Maduro presented the same program that Chavez presented. I assume that Capriles would do the same. What he did when he campaigned in October, His program basically was, a collection of policies oriented to solve macroeconomic equilibriums in Venezuela, and with a strong emphasis in improving efficiency in many of the social policies that Chavez have implemented. There is, in the part of the opposition, it's very important to talk about civil liberties and political rights and reestablishing independence of the institutions.
And that's something, because Venezuela is still a multi-party republic, mm-hmm. but there's certainly been charges that Chavez has been an autocrat, that he has, mm-hmm. while bringing some people in the political process, he's also shut down or limited the access that his opponents have to the process and to the media.
Yeah, certainly that has been the case. And objectively, what has happened through these years of Chavez rule is that we have a political system where, elections happen very frequently, actually. And in addition to elections, there are referendums and so on. So it's very participatory from the point of view of using this mechanism. But at the same time, you have a president that stuck all the institutions with followers and supporters. And therefore, we lost the independence of and the check and balance that should be in a liberal democracy.
Have there been any problems with corruption or just plain incompetence in any particular agencies?
There have been a lot of allegations about corruption in different state agencies and ministers, but the problem is that there is no following up with that. There have not been really, trials or decisions in corruption cases because precisely the fact that the institutions are biased with the government. So,
with the change in leadership, whoever wins the April election, what do you see as being the really big problems that Venezuela has to deal with right now? What will be on the plate of the next president?
Yeah. Well, there is economic issues that need to be addressed. Venezuela, the government have a huge fiscal debt. So this need to be balanced, the federal government. Maduro, during his interim president, before Chavez died, announced a devaluation of the currency of the Bolivar. About 50% was devalued. This has happened in the last decade 5 times. So the Bolivar has lost his value about 90% since Chavez is in government.
90%?
Yeah. So this is the issue of inflation. It's also quite important. In February, the last quarter of the month, the inflation was 22%. The inflation in Venezuela today is one of the largest in Latin America, highest in Latin America and in the world, actually. So these are issues, macroeconomic issues that need to be addressed. And crime is also a very important issue. Venezuela, in Caracas and other cities in Venezuela, are one of the most violent in the region. This is a very critical issue that the society and the population also have identified as one of the main problems. So these are definitely.
What has Venezuela's relations with other nations in the Americas been under Chavez?
Yeah.
We certainly understand that there are a lot of people in the U.S. who aren't crazy about the government, but we're still trading partners, I understand, so
sure.
We haven't gone too far away.
Yeah. No. The United States is the best client and the main partner of Venezuela oil exports, although have reduced over the last year, I guess, recognizing that it's not a reliable ally, have reduced the imports from Venezuela. So that is something that is happening. But to get to your question, Chavez was very active in foreign policy. Seeking for integration in Latin America and creating a multipolar world. And he worked very energetically in establishing alliances with other Latin American countries.
Did he make any headway?
He created, you know, there is the ALBA, which is an initiative that Venezuela initiated with Cuba, Nicaragua, Bolivia, Ecuador, and some Caribbean nations. It's a kind of bloc, economic and social bloc, but also the Union of South American Nations, which include all South American nations, and under the model of the European Union, that's the idea, create the Bank of the South, and so on. So, yes, there were different initiatives and actual institutions that have been created to advance this idea of Latin American integration.
Is that something lasting that's going to continue beyond Chavez?
I think that there is the potential for that, yeah, because many countries in the region also have endorsed this idea. And Brazil is active, at least in the Bank of the South, the Union of South America, Mercosur, and obviously Brazil is one of the, you know, the central leader in Latin America. So,
I can't resist asking about one piece of news that came out shortly after Chavez's death, and that's the plans to embalm his body and put it on display, not unlike the body of Vladimir Lenin in the old Soviet Union, and of course that body is still on display in Russia today. Is that going to happen? And it's not what Chavez himself was seeking, was it?
The interim president Nicolas Maduro made the announcement that decision was taken. The family hasn't made any pronouncement, but I assume that they support that, and that the body of Chavez was going to be embalmed, and perhaps more importantly than that, or with that, is that they are going to amend the constitution so Chavez can, I mean, the body can be displayed in, it's called the Panteón Nacional. This is a building where the rest of Simón Bolívar, the hero of independence, are. So Chavez is going to be next to Bolívar if the constitution and amendment pass, which I assume will, because the government has the majority in the parliament. So, you know, I guess that would be true.
Is there enough of a cult of personality for Chavez for, you know, do you expect to see lines waiting to go see his embalmed remains?
Well, that's still happening. I mean, during, you know, he still is in display. He hasn't been because he's going to be embalmed. So I assume that with time that would decrease. But, yeah, I expect that the cult of personality is strong enough that is something that is going to remain in Venezuela on consciousness. Yeah.
Well, this sounds like Venezuela. It sounds like there are a lot of unknowns facing Venezuela right now. Mm-hmm. And just the next few months could be very important for the country.
Yeah, definitely. First, we have this election, but more important than the outcome of the election, I think, is what is going to happen now with a Chavista government without Chavez, in this post-Chavez era. For them, it's very important to win this election, to win it strong, to show that they can stand by themselves without this, you know, all-dominant figure that was Hugo Chavez.
Well, we're at the midpoint of our program where we have to say goodbye to Professor Damaris Ganache, since she has to leave for another engagement. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
It's time for a short break, and we'll be back to talk about Cuba with Theodore Pacon of the Brookings Institute. This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Welcome back to Focus on WYLL. From Venezuela and Hugo Chavez, we go to the Castro regime in Cuba. The Castro brothers are holding on, but they're both in their 80s now, and Raul Castro says he'll step down as president when his new term runs out in 5 years. Right now, they're also dealing with the death of Hugo Chavez, who had been a great ally of Cuba over the years, helping to fill the aid gap created by the fall of the Soviet Union. Meanwhile, Cuba's relations with the U.S. have been problematic, dating back to before many of us were born. But our next guest has argued for improvements, albeit discreet and gradual ones, in U.S.-Cuban relations. Ted Pacon is a senior fellow and deputy director of foreign policy with the Brookings Institute. Ted, welcome to Focus.
Thank you very much.
And I should say again, we welcome you to the conversation for this next half hour. With your questions about Cuba, give a call to 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again, 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. And Ted, one thing that struck me was a news item I saw noting that Fidel Castro, who had not been heard from much recently, had written another installment of his column. It sounds like just to note the death of Hugo Chavez, who is described as a great friend of Cuba.
Well, Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez were very close indeed, and they had described their relationship almost like a father and son friendship, and of course it went beyond just a personal emotional relationship. It led to tremendous support from Venezuela to Cuba during some very difficult periods for Cuba, and that support continues.
Do you expect that support to continue in the years to come?
I do, at least for the short term, and I think it all hinges on what happens in the elections in Venezuela next month, but all predictions are that Nicolas Maduro will win and probably win handily. And he has, of course, completely embraced the Chavez model. And I think that would include support to Cuba along the lines it has been carrying out for the last several years. That includes 115,000 barrels a day of oil at highly subsidized rates. So much oil, in fact, that Cuba then turns around and re-exports some of that oil at much higher rates to the international market. So it's an important way for Cuba to earn hard currency into its coffers. There's also an exchange of technical support, everything from teachers, coaches and athletes, medical professionals, doctors, nurses, etc., as well as security and intelligence professionals. So it's a very, very close, codependent type of relationship. There's also the ideological affinity between the two models of socialism that are kind of emerging in Venezuela and under some change in Cuba.
About a year ago, you wrote a piece that's on the Brookings Institute website entitled "Cuba is Changing Slowly but Surely." Is that still the case?
That is still the case. I wrote that upon my first trip to Havana and was the result of a number of conversations that we had, some of them quite discreet and confidential, but nonetheless conveying a sense that Cuba was turning a corner in terms of its it was prepared, its leaders were prepared to, number one, hand power to a younger generation. Number two, allow they don't call it a private sector, they call it a non-state sector, but to allow individuals to open their own businesses, to buy and sell property and cars. So there were elements of some kind of independence from the state, at least economically speaking. And then I also heard language about, and you see this in the public speeches of Raul Castro for some time now, that, you know, it's time for the Cubans to work harder and to become citizens, to take on more responsibility for themselves and less total dependence on the state. So when you start hearing language like that from even the most senior leaders on the island, it's pretty obvious that there is change underway. Now, the implementation of the reforms are quite slow. This is intentional. The leadership wants to maintain control of the situation. They don't want it to get out of hand, as we certainly have seen in other countries, particularly after the fall of the Berlin Wall in Eastern Europe. And so they want to go slow, but, you know, now we're accumulating a good 2 to 3 years since these reforms were implemented, and you're starting to see some interesting changes.
What are there any particular changes that you could point to of being of special interest?
I think one of the most dramatic ones that just took effect in January is the giving Cubans permission to leave the island. They relaxed the rules. They did away with a special permission that was required that really meant it was extremely difficult. They reduced the fees for leaving the country. They reduced the requirements of someone needing an invitation from an external country. They just need a passport and a visa, assuming they're going to a country that requires a visa. Not all countries do require a visa. That's, I think, a dramatic change. And some of the individuals who have now received a passport and have left are people who are speaking out publicly in other countries about what life is really like in Cuba. Their expectation is that they will return to Cuba, and the new rules allow people to leave and return more easily. I think that's a very interesting, important change. Of course, from the government's point of view, the desire here is to help Cubans go abroad, establish themselves, perhaps earn money, send remittances back home, and create a flow of exchange and commerce among the Cuban diaspora and with other individuals that will, in the end, help the Cuban economy.
Well, the Cubans who are going off to visit other countries, are any of them coming to the U.S.?
Oh, yes. I don't have the numbers. There's always a fairly steady flow of Cubans coming to the United States. The United States reserves 20,000 visas a year for Cubans to come to the United States. And then there are several thousands who leave the island through other means, either by boat or they get to Mexico and they cross the border in the southwest. And as soon as they enter the United States, whether they have legal papers or not, our immigration laws allow them special privileges to stay in our country, to apply for a green card, and in effect to cut the line and to shortcut. They also receive certain benefits, medical health, housing assistance, that other immigrants do not receive. This is a leftover from the Cold War. It's not really, it no longer makes sense. I think as part of the immigration debate that we currently have underway, it's time for Congress to take a look at this and regularize the status. These are economic migrants. These are not political refugees. Now, some are political refugees, and they, of course, can declare themselves as political refugees. I'm not denying that at all. But this blanket privilege is for any Cuban setting foot in the United States is a bit too much.
Part of the Cold War picture of U.S.-Cuban relations had been the idea, I think, of families that were torn apart with refugees who had made it to America while other loved ones were still in Cuba and they were unable to make contact with each other again, at least not in person. Is that something that's changed now, or is that something that had already been changing?
Well, it had really begun changing in fits and starts thanks to some changes that U.S. administrations had adopted, going actually back to President Clinton, and then President Bush restricted the ability of Cuban Americans to return to Cuba, and then President Obama in 2009 lifted those restrictions and has basically made it it's an open license for any Cuban American to go visit their families in Cuba, and they can also send unlimited amount of remittances, cash, gifts, and whatnot to their families on the island. And this is turning out to be a lifeline, not only for those specific families in Cuba, but for the Cuban economy. I mean, in the last few years, over $2 billion in remittances has been sent from the Cuban diaspora back to Cuba. And that money, in addition to just sustaining some of these families, is being invested into the opening of these new businesses now that that's allowed under the Cuban rules. So you see new restaurants, barbershops, private hotels in people's homes, a number of other small businesses that are being opened. And if you ask those people, a lot of them are relying on support from their families in Miami.
That sounds like the sort of day-to-day thing you would expect to happen. I'm wondering also about more dramatic things. I mean, an incident like the Ileana Gonzalez affair from several years back, it just would not happen today.
Yeah, you don't see that kind of drama, fortunately. That was a very difficult period, I think, for all concerned, and still actually resonates for some of the families in Miami. But I think that is the past, and there's much greater interaction now. You're seeing folks who have who had left Cuba under very difficult circumstances in the 50s and 60s going back for the first time in 50 years. And that's always a dramatic and emotional thing to happen. But you have a number of Cubans who came to the United States more recently, say in the last 10 years, who have always gone back and forth more readily and don't have the, say, the emotional baggage about going back. And I think that will continue to accelerate.
Well, how will that change affect U.S.-Cuban relations? It's my understanding that it was the Cuban-American community in the U.S. who were leaders in supporting the trade embargo between the U.S. and Cuba.
And that remains the case. There is a minority coalition, mostly of Cuban-Americans, who are very hard on maintaining and in some cases even tightening the embargo. But the general view within the Cuban-American community and certainly within the U.S. population more broadly is changing relatively quickly. You saw that, you see it in certain polling that's taking place, but also you saw it in the elections in last November when President Obama received 10 points more votes than 4 years earlier in the Miami-Dade community. So his support from the Cuban-American community voters in Miami has improved dramatically. And I think that's a sign that, you know, generations are moving on, that for the most part, most Cuban-Americans appreciate the changes that President Obama has made to make it easier for them to travel and send remittances. And I think that's just going to continue with time as generations change.
I think you yourself, I was looking at a video of a talk you gave in January where you called for some, I guess, some discrete actions by the Obama administration to try to open up the communications lines between the U.S. and Cuba for some future progress.
I propose basically two types of measures. One are unilateral steps that the president can take on his own under his executive authority without having to go to Congress. You know, Congress codified the embargo some 10 years ago now, more than that. So Congress would have to act to lift the embargo. But there are elements of executive authority at play here. The president can assert his executive authority and make exceptions to the embargo. That's the authority he's already used for the travel and remittances that I mentioned previously. So, for example, going back to the question of the businesses that are opening up now in Cuba, the president could allow Americans, any American, to buy goods from those private businesses in Cuba, and that would give them some new customers to sell their goods to. You know, could be artisan crafts, for example. Right now, an American who goes to Cuba mostly would have to be on a special license, cannot buy those things from those independent businesses. And I think that's not where we want to be. We want to be helping those businesses grow. So that's one step the president can do. There are a number of others that I outline to increase the people-to-people dialogue and exchanges and contact. We have to get to know each other much, much better. And I think it's really very simple for the president to actually authorize that in no time. There are another set of measures that I propose that are actually, I think, should happen under the umbrella of direct negotiations, that it's time, without preconditions, for a senior representative of the U.S. government to sit down with senior representative of the Cuban government and have a dialogue and put things on the table that have not been there yet. It's long overdue. One issue that could be addressed fairly quickly, and I think there's a lot of agreement on this, Cuba is on the U.S. state sponsor of terrorism list. Yet there's no evidence to support it, and I think anyone who looks seriously at this issue would recognize that Cuba is no longer a state sponsor of terrorism. If anything, they're actually contributing to dealing with some tough terrorism issues, for example, in sponsoring peace talks between the government of Colombia and the FARC rebels in Colombia. So that's one thing that the United States could do, but I suggest it be done part of a dialogue with a lot of other issues on the table. There's another difficult issue, which is the arrest and imprisonment of a U.S. citizen named Alan Gross in Cuba. And I think that's another issue that could be addressed in the context of direct talks.
That's certainly something that's not helping U.S.-Cuba relations right now.
Well, the United States decided when he was arrested that as a form of protest, we would stop all forms of, most forms of cooperation with Cuba, even the migration talks, which are really important bilateral set of talks that used to happen every 6 to 12 months. Those have been frozen as well. A number of things have been frozen that are really not in our interest. We need to be working with the Cubans on a number of things, whether it's counter-narcotics cooperation or, in the case of an environmental disaster in the Gulf of Mexico, on Cuban off Cuban waters, that could easily and directly affect Florida. We need to have mechanisms in place to be able to address that quickly with the Cubans. There are a number of issues like that that could be addressed, and we're not doing it.
Well, this is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Still a little time for your questions about Cuba. For Ted Picone of the Brookings Institute, call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again, 333-WILL, or toll free at 800-222-WILL. Ted, I was thinking that just the existence of the Castros, of Fidel Castro, carries a great deal of symbolic importance in the U.S., and though it's a morbid way of looking at it, but if the Castros weren't there, would that make it easier for the U.S. To open up greater communications with Cuba?
Well, in theory, I think it would. It would be the passing of an era, and I think it would allow a lot of politicians to say, okay, let's now something's different in Cuba. But we have to be clear about what's really happening in terms of political control in Cuba. It does not depend on Fidel Castro remaining alive, or Raul for that matter. And we saw that most recently at the latest National Assembly, which just took place in Havana in February. And Raul Castro announced the appointment of a new vice president, who is the first senior official of that rank from the post-revolutionary period. He's only 52 years old, Miguel Diaz-Canel. He came from the provinces. He served as a leader there. He served as Minister of Education, more of a technocrat, pragmatic kind of guy. And in effect, we're looking at a future Cuba that's going to be run by people who have the kind of ideological bona fides, loyalty to the revolution, but are also younger, more pragmatic in updating the model to deal with, you know, 21st century. And that process is already underway. And with Raul serving as president for 5 more years, it gives time for the baton to be handed to this new generation, and I would expect that continuity to unfold relatively smoothly. Now, there are lots of scenarios that would suggest a different result. I think you have a relatively quiet civil society community, but nonetheless, they are there. They're important voices, and they've been repressed, unfortunately, all these years. But they are an important voice. The Catholic Church is emerging as an important center of reflection and dialogue, and even criticism of the Cuban model, and a willingness to really engage in direct and indirect forms of dissent.
Well, Ted, I'm sorry to break in, just noticing the time that we have left. But speaking of voices on Cuba, let's take a call. And I wanted to say hello to David in Urbana. Hello, you're on the air with Ted Pacon on Focus.
Hello. It seems to me that one of the basic impediments to improved relationship between... Pardon me, I have a little problem with my voice this morning. Improvement of the relations between the two countries is a profound misunderstanding of Cuban history on the part of a very large part of the American population, particularly among my Republican friends. There seems to be this belief that somehow Castro overthrew a democratic and enlightened government in Cuba and replaced it with a tyranny. And not to argue the fact that Castro is a dictator, or was, the predecessors in Cuba were hardly democratic idealists, or perhaps for the last 15 years before Castro, the strongest controlling force was the Chicago Mafia. And Castro, for all his faults, never instituted programs on the scale of the Chilean and Argentinian disappearances. I believe that when he took power, the literacy rate in Cuba was, what, about 20%? And it had one of the highest infant mortality rates, and for that matter, maternal fatality rates in Latin America.
Well, that brings something up, and I'm sorry, David, with just a couple of minutes to go, I wanted to ask Ted Pacon, what should Americans know about the pre-Castro history of Cuba?
Well, I think David's right to remind us of just how much baggage there is in not only, of course, Cuban history, but U.S.-Cuban relations. Everything from Guantanamo to Cuban missile crisis and many other incidents that have, you know, painted each side into a corner deeper and deeper, makes it hard to get out of this tit-for-tat relationship, which seems somewhat ridiculous for a big, powerful country like the United States to be playing that kind of game with what is, frankly, a relatively small and weak country. And I think it will be hard for Americans to turn the page, but frankly, it'll be much harder for the Cubans because they feel like they have suffered under this embargo, which is the toughest embargo of any we have against any country in the world, you know, for over 50 years. And it has made their lives more difficult, and yet they have achieved quite remarkable social progress despite the embargo. So I think that's part of the process of, you know, having greater direct contact with Cubans, understanding better what their history really means and our own history, and would help to start turn the page.
Well, I think we're going to have to leave it at that. Like our earlier conversation about Venezuela with Professor Damaris Kanachi, we can talk about Cuba for a great deal longer, and there's certainly going to be more news coming out of that country in the years to come. Ted Pacon of the Brookings Institute, thank you very much for joining us today on Focus.
You're welcome.
And we welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. You can go to it directly at will.illinois.edu/focus, or we're likely the first result on your search engine under WILL of Focus. You now have a second chance to hear this program. Our replay is each weeknight at 8 on WILL AM 580. We are also available as a free downloadable podcast. To sign up, visit the Focus page of our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. On tomorrow's show, the topic is economic development, local economic development. We'll talk about what's been done and what could be done in the Champaign-Urbana and Danville areas with Vicki Hogan, President and CEO of Vermilion Advantage, and Mike Kirchhoff, President and CEO of the Champaign County Economic Development Corporation. That's on tomorrow's program. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director and handles your calls. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WILL.